play a novel like The Spider's House, which I think is a marvelous piece of work. It's too difficult a novel. It relies on knowledge. And The Spider's House is, which is essentially it's about a novel about the Moroccan revolution against France, and about a Moroccan sensibility. It's the first novel which has as one of the protagonists an Arab. After that, a lot of his short stories become totally populated with Moroccans. But, you know, Americans couldn't deal with this. I mean, the reviews were of this novel were totally bewildering. And they were because they were bewildered by the novel. What, you know, you had to know all this stuff that was going on, and who cares whether Morocco gets independent or not? And is Morocco the same as Algeria? And nobody wanted to read about this. It wasn't about, they wanted now to have American characters doing things on the main street in America. Whereas I think after the war, because there was a tremendous interest in Europe, you know, the Marshall Plan was going on. You had thousands of, you know, there were 50,000 Americans living in Paris in 1949. You had a tremendous number of people coming over here to study on the GI Bill, or who had been soldiers here, who had gone by Dumagol and seen Sartre and Beauvoir sitting out there. So you had a sort of, at the very, right after the war, in the early, very early part of the decade of the 50s, you had an awareness and, in fact, an interest in things European, in things continental, in exotic settings. And by the mid-50s, if you look at the novels that are sort of making it onto the bestseller list, what you're going to see are novels that are basically about America. And then, you know, you get, of course, the, you know, probably the most quintessential American novel that period's On the Road, which, despite all the predictions, in fact, Kerouac hit it at exactly the right moment, because this was a whole new movie. And vilified and considered a total degenerate, Americans were interested in reading about themselves, or in reading about people doing things in America. They didn't want these foreign people, you know, Arabs as characters. And I think, and then I think the other problem is that the last novel that he wrote, which is called Up Above the World, is just not such a good novel. It's a confusing novel, and it just doesn't have the sort of elan or something that the other ones have. He actually didn't want to put his name on it. He wanted to use a pseudonym. And the publisher said, no, we have to sell this as a pulp, as a novel. It didn't do anything. His stories continued to be absolutely wonderful and absolutely unread in the United States. And so by the 70s, with the exception of Echo Press in New York and Bloxborough in Santa Barbara and City Lights, which are all small, you know, relatively, Echo's a fairly good-sized press, but the others are small presses. You know, Bowles was just only for the very, very few. People were interested in other things at that point, and I think that's really the, you know, he got forgotten also. I think part of it was, you know, he put himself into exile by going to Tangier, and he's never regretted it. But I think that had he been able to show up on the Jack Parr show or Johnny Carson, had he been able to go to the right cocktail parties in New York, talk to people, had he been able to sort of cultivate his persona, he wouldn't have probably been forgotten. God knows a lot. Well, let's put it this way. Several lesser writers maintained their prominence in America, even while not living there, by making frequent trips back or by still writing about American subjects. And Bowles did not. I think it was just, you know, being out of it. He really didn't understand what the Americans wanted to read either.
And isn't a lot of that still true today, all of what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe even more so. I think it's switching back a bit. And I think the fact that Bowles is beginning to receive a little more prominence now is because Americans are once again interested in maybe journeying out of Milwaukee or St. Paul or Dubuque, Iowa, or wherever the hell it is, somewhere in the Midwest, you know, California, you know, even, I mean, he, like, you know, when I went back to try to get books in 1980, I couldn't find him in most bookstores. I mean, Gotham Book Mart, obviously, you know, in New York, or, you know, would have him, but you had to go to Gotham, basically, or the Phoenix Bookshop, or some of the you know, say, real bookshops, the independent bookshops, essentially. So I think what happened is, in a certain way, Bowles kind of lost touch with what American readers were wanting. I don't think it would have made any difference. I can't imagine him writing a novel to please anybody ever. The fact that The Sheldon Sky was a bestseller was a total surprise to me. He didn't have any interest in writing a bestseller. I think that had he been maybe more present in America, he could have written about American things, but it never interested him. He didn't like America. He didn't want to stay in America, and he hasn't. So, you know, now I think it's okay. We're once again interested in exotic locales. A few people, anyway.
Yeah. Actually, what I meant when I said, isn't that still the case today? I meant not just for Bowles, but for other writers. Perhaps
course.
Even more so if they're up and coming.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Mm. I think it's, well, I mean, if you look at, say, the Brat Pack writers, some of whom I genuinely admire, there's a definite tendency to write about themes that are on the Oprah Winfrey Show, sex and drugs and homosexuality and rock and roll. And that's pretty safe territory.
In America,
yeah. Yeah. They're not writing about...
Or in New York,
yeah. Yeah, they're not writing... In New York publishing, anyway. Mm. You know, they're not writing about, getting raped in the Sahara.
Mm.
So there's, you know, there's definitely a difference. I mean, and, you know, who knows? I mean, this can all change. I mean, there may be a great swing back.
Mm.
There's certainly a lot of Americans in Paris this thing.
That's right.
More, I think, actually, than I've seen in
ever.
Recent years. No, not ever, but more than in recent
more than
years.
Seen,
yeah.
More than recent years, yeah.
Of course, I'm right in the crossroads, too, so that may be what it is. I've never lived in Saint Michel, so...
Well, actually, that's a good lead-in for the next question, which is, you're in Paris this month doing research for your next book on Paris expatriates from 1945 to 1960. You spoke of approaching the subject with a tone completely different from that of the Bowles book, one subjective, passionate, even perhaps opinionated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Gee, now I'm going to commit myself to this. No, I think there's a difference. I think there's a lot of differences. First of all, doing the Bowles biography... in a certain way, I'm very limited by what I do there. I'm dealing with one person's life, and one person's writings. And obviously, had I not had a certain enthusiasm for the writer and the work, I wouldn't have done it.
Mm.
So it almost creates a kind of situation in which the value judgments that I make about him and his life, well, at times they may be cutting,
mm-hmm.
are for the most part going to be, I'm going to be predisposed towards presenting my subject in the best light, including his work, because I wanted people to read Bowles. I think with this book it's different, because, first of all, I feel that a lot of the writers who came to Paris after the Second World War are vastly underrated and neglected, the same way Bowles was. And I guess in that way I'm on a literary mission. And I think some of them have been overrated. And what I'm really interested in doing in this book, in a certain way, is carving out a mm-hmm. territory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're probably, well, as I sit in this room, there I can see probably 50 books in here about Paris in the 20s and 30s. And there, as far as I know, there is not yet one about Paris in the late 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So while some of these writers, you know, like James Jones or Irwin Shaw, are well known to Americans, and there have been biographies and all the rest of it. A lot of them are not well known. Part of it is, again, because they've been living in Paris, or because they wrote stories that were not fashionable at the time, or novels that were not fashionable in their time, or were published by small presses. And what I'm really interested in looking at in this book is the sort of the panorama. Mm. So how do you live in a city like Paris after it's been devastated by war? How do you, the crucial questions for a lot of these people, really, how do you recover from that war? Because many of them were in the war, they were soldiers. How does a people recover from the war? How does a literature recover from the war? And so I think those are some of the different concerns. Value judgments are being made all the time, because the ones that I choose to write about are obviously the ones that I feel are either very important or, in fact, maybe never written about. So I think that's a major difference. I'm a bit more confident on this book, mm-hmm. because I know Paris pretty well. A lot of the writers that I'm writing about, well, not a lot, but well, actually, yeah, I would say probably a good number of them anyway, I've known, mm-hmm. I know, I'm on good terms with. And I'm not also trying to dissect the nitty-gritties of their lives and relationships with mothers and fathers and, mm-hmm. and brothers and sisters and wives and husbands and boyfriends and girlfriends mm-hmm. and both. And so it makes it, I think, a little easier task. It is, in a certain way, a group biography, because it's a biography of everybody who was here. Mm-hmm. But because of the nature of the book, instead of writing 5,000 pages, I'll probably be writing 500, I have to, of necessity, limit it to more or less what happened in Paris, mm-hmm. what was important to them about Paris, why Paris. Mm-hmm. And I think there were many, many reasons why they were in Paris, but I think those reasons were quite different mm-hmm. from the reasons that sent the Lost Generation over. And I'm interested in looking at that.
Okay. Actually, I think I mistakenly skipped two questions that would have...
Yeah, that's okay, yeah.
Made that less of an abrupt jump. One was...
You know, when you do this, sure. edit it around any way you want.
Sure,
it doesn't.
Okay.
There's absolutely nothing sacred about the order.
Okay.
You can even invent lines for me if you come to think of something better.
Yeah, I did skip two things. One
sure.
was, did I ask you this about the atmosphere? How the atmosphere of Tangier impressed itself on your writing? Did I ask you that?
Well, no, you didn't. I think in a certain way I answered it was talking about going to Bowles' house, but I can give you a little answer to it. I think what for me the major benefit of having spent time in Tangier was, at least for me, was that I began to understand much more the reality of Bowles' writing. Mm-hmm. When you're in Morocco as an outsider, you really are an outsider in a way you are in a few cultures. Mm. Having lived in Japan, where I was always an outsider, there's a very different feeling about that from being in Morocco, where you're never quite sure of what footing you're really on. I can remember walking down through the Medina one night around midnight, and suddenly these two guys came out, burnouses and jalabas, the whole works, out of this little tiny street, and confronted me in the street, and said something to me in Arabic, and I thought, oh my God, I'm in a Paul Bowles novel, and all they wanted was to know if I had a match so they could light their cigarette, and it was perfectly innocuous, but there's a certain...
That could be the start of a marvelous story.
Yeah, it could be, yeah. Actually, I have a marvelous story about Tangier that I wrote, but I won't go into that now. And various things happened in Tangier. I had very... probably go to jail if I tell this story, but... had situations with changing money in Tangier that were highly irregular. that make the labyrinthine proceedings and let it come down seem absolutely the most normal thing in the world. That's all I'll say about that. Drugs are very much a way of life in Tangier. It's a very natural thing. And if you read Bowles's, particularly the later stories, all of his characters are always smoking keef, which is a mixture of tobacco and pot. And this isn't just Bowles's sort of take on things. That's the way it is. One also senses the kind of love that the Moroccans have for storytelling, the love that they have for their own traditions. It's dying quickly, and Bowles is, I think, in a certain way, because of his translations, has helped to preserve that. Now, you know, the old days, you went into a cafe, all the old men would sit around and tell stories. Now you go in, they're watching television. But that's progress, I guess. So I think that what that did was gave me a perspective on the work that said, this isn't really impossible. In fact, the story of the Delicate Prey, which is absolutely one of the most horrific stories that one will ever read, is really based on an actual incident. And many of Bowles's pieces are tied to something that actually happened. And so rather than being a sort of a fabulation, these are actual, they're fabulations on a reality.
One gets that sense reading this work.
Yeah. So it's not the land of make-believe. Mm. I mean, Bowles cranks it up sometimes, but basically it's all there. And I think one of the things that Bowles does so chillingly is continually reminds the reader that when you are an interloper in someone else's culture, there may be consequences. Mm. And one is always, I think, aware of that in Morocco. And
earlier you said that, as if impressed by Bowles' own style, you chose to describe Bowles in a somewhat, this was the lead-in, distanced fashion. The reader can't help but be impressed by the abundance of factual detail here and the tying together of people and places in Bowles' life. Yet what about your own subjective experience of Bowles? What was your essential impression of Bowles as a man?
Okay. Again, I think I pretty much chronicled that in the sense that, you know, initially I found him very, very affable, very warm. I think as I got to know him better, I realized that there was a far more complex matter. What I mean by that is that he's very ambivalent about people, and the moods change very quickly. People that often think that they're very close to him suddenly find out that they aren't, inexplicably. And people who think sometimes that he could care less about them suddenly realize that he cares deeply about them. I think that Bowles has practiced being the old gentleman in Tangier for a long time, and underneath that facade that he puts out is a person who's really rather nihilistic, like the work. I wouldn't say by any means death obsessed, but death aware. I don't know how often he said to me, I'd say, I'll see you tomorrow or something. He said, if I'm still here, or inshallah, which is his usual expression, which means God willing. There's a definite morbidity. And there's even to some extent, I think, and I think this comes actually from being detached a lot from, say, New York or his publishers or whatever. There's a certain almost irrationality connected with what he perceives as exploitation of him by publishers. It may be true, it may not be true, but there's definitely, he definitely feels, I think, that being in Tangier, he's always a victim. He's a victim of the Moroccans. He's a victim of of the you know, businessmen or the bankers, of his accountant, of you know, the IRS, as we all are. But I think with bulls, it's almost something that he rather enjoys.